So we're looking at Hindu philosophy today, and I'd draw your attention to the work of Wilhelm Humphass on Indian philosophy.
Can I have a hand up, please?
No. I've run out, so you have to give you one.
You need to take it from me, I'll take it from the inside.
Thank you.
Okay. So what's the one?
Humphass, Wilhelm Humphass.
H-A-L-B-F-A-S-S, he's on here.
He's on here.
That's on there, the first bullet point.
That's right, yes. So the question, that's the question, why study Indian philosophy, is quite a quote from Humphass that I've given here. We can expect genuine discoveries and can we expect genuine discoveries and clarifications from Indian texts? Should we expect nothing more than exotic cases of conceptual and theoretical confusion and exemplifications of linguistic and cultural relativity? Do these texts deal with questions that are still significant for us? Can they teach us about different questions and about other types of significance? Have we gone beyond the Indian questions and answers, or may we hope to rediscover dimensions of the problem of being that have been neglected, obscured, or buried by the development and ostensible progress of Western philosophy and science? Can we expect to clarify our own tradition of ontological thought, its meaning and limits, by comparing or contrasting it with the Indian tradition? So I think that's raises interesting questions there. And certainly many contemporary philosophers think that the Indian tradition can indeed throw light on contemporary Western philosophical problems, particularly Jonardhan Guneri and his work on his book Semantic Powers, and indeed his teacher Matilal, and Ramprasad at Lancaster as well. So Indian philosophy is taken seriously in some departments of Western philosophy, but not many. And Indian departments of philosophy themselves tend to be sort of Western focused, tend to be, you know, you get courses of Wittgenstein, Kant, and but not much about the inheritance of the Indian tradition itself, particularly in terms of on logic. So the concern of Humphass is ontology, but there's also a long tradition of epistemology in India as well. One of the problems about philosophy is it's a problem of terminology. What are the semantic equivalents of philosophy in Hinduism or Indian traditions? And you've got two terms, a darshana and anvikshiki. Darshana means from the root drish to see. So I suppose critical worldview might be a good translation of darshana. It's often just loosely translated as philosophy. And anvikshiki is something like analysis or investigation. Or investigative science, and particularly logic. Yeah.
Beg your pardon.
That's okay.
Turn that off. I didn't think it was on.
You said about darshana. Sorry, you said
darshana. Darshana, yeah. It means a critical worldview. It's from the root drish to see, critical worldview. And it's often just loosely translated as system of philosophy.
Anvikshiki.
I haven't got the diacritical marks in the text here. Which is analysis on investigative science, particularly logic. Now, the term darshana refers to not only Hindu, if you like, systems of thought, but also to Buddhist and Jain ones as well. There's a very interesting book composed in the 14th century by Madhva called The Compendium of All Philosophies, the Sarva Darshana Sangraha, which contains almost like a phenomenology of Indian philosophy, because it contains succinct summaries of the different philosophical positions and presents some criticism of them in a fairly neutral kind of way. It's a very interesting text, very early for that kind of dispassionate analysis. And there it uses the word darshana, and it presents various darshanas, and it doesn't really distinguish between the Hindu ones and the non-Hindu ones. The the Bowder views of the different schools of Buddhism, different Jain traditions are represented there. And it presents about 15 or 16 darshans. So that's worth looking at. It's translated by Cowell, C-O-W-E-L-L. Now, the main features of these darshanas are that they assume the Veda as revelation, that the orthodox ones do. The orthodox Hindu ones use the word Hindu in a qualified sense. And they claim to have liberation as their purpose. What's the point of Indian? What's the point of philosophy? The point is liberation. So it's philosophy as a way of life, in a way, to use that phrase by Adol with regard to the Greeks. So they claim to have liberation as their purpose. And they're exegetical in nature, and they're expressed in commentaries and sub-commentaries on revelation and on primary texts called sutras, which form the scriptural sources of a school. And especially important here is the Vedanta Sutra. So you've got the Veda, which we've looked at. They regard that the orthodox darshanas assume they are revelation, and they're exegetical or hermeneutical. They're based on the interpretation of texts. And the orthodox schools are called, what do we got it written down here? Astika. Astika refers to the traditions of regard the Veda as revelation. It's a verb. It's a kind of noun formed from a verb. And nastika, it is not. The texts are not revelation. They disclaim revelation. So this is, of course, a Hindu or nastika classification. So these are the six orthodox schools are regarded as astika because they regard the Veda as revelation. And the Gnosticas are the Bowders, the Buddhists and the Jains and the materialists and any other groups. But within that system, the Shaiva tradition tends to be excluded, as we'll see. So it has its limits, this actual classification. So, okay, that's the main features of the darshanas. They assume the Veda as revelation, the Astika darshanas. They claim to have liberation as their purpose, and they're hermeneutical or exegetical based on the primary text of the tradition of revelation, and also the sutras which follow from the primary texts. And two primary issues in India philosophy is what is there, what exists, ontology, and how can we know anything, epistemology, the standard classical concerns of Western philosophy as well. We can divide Indian philosophy into various periods. This is a general scheme that most people would sort of accept, probably. Pre-systematic speculation of the Vedas and Upanishads. The classical systems of Hinduism, Buddhism and Jainism from about 400 BC to the 12th century, a very long period of development. And then you get the theistic tradition of the Shaiva and Vaishnava systems, and indeed the Shakta system as well, from the 8th to the 18th centuries. Then more theology, as we would understand the term theology. And then you get modern Indian philosophy, which responds to Western philosophy in the 19th and 20th centuries. So that's the general classification of the different periods. In the pre-systematic speculation of the Vedas and Upanishads, you do have some hymns, which are speculative in nature. So one of the hymns from the Rig Veda asks, what was in the beginning? Was there something or nothing? Was there being, sat, or non-being, asat? And it's rather a nice text. It's a sort of Indian skepticism begins here as well, in a way, because it says, only he in the highest heaven knows, and it ends, or perhaps he does not know, which is quite nice. So you certainly get the notion of being and non-being from the beginnings in the Vedas and the Upanishads. And the Upanishads are very concerned with the nature of existence, what is, asking that question, what's the basis of the universe, what's the foundation, what's the underlying basis, as the pre-Socratic Greeks were as well. So Thales, all is water, you know, it's that kind of thing. What is the foundation of the universe? Breath, fire, and the Upanishads eventually come up with Brahman, this essence, this absolute essence underlying everything. Now, the six orthodox systems which developed during the classical period are divided into three pairs, and this is them: Samkhya Yoga, Samkhya and Yoga. I'll go through them in a minute. Mimamsa and Vedanta, Nyaya and Vaisheshika. Now, it's a somewhat artificial systematization from the medieval period, which excludes major developments, particularly in Shaivism. I've got Madhva's text there. Madhva's Compendium of All Philosophy, the Sarva Darshana Sangraha, about 1340. It's 16 philosophical schools and doesn't mention the term of the six systems at all. So, it's also Max Muller is partly responsible for this in his book, The Six Systems of Indian Philosophy, in the 1890s. But generally, it's a very popular, it's a very common theme that in contemporary Hinduism, there are six schools of orthodox, six schools of philosophy, six systems of philosophy. But we must bear in mind that it was a fairly late classification. And it excludes the Shaiva tradition, so it's probably a classification from within the Vedanta tradition itself. So the first school in the Samkhya and Yoga, Samkhya is probably one of the older, possibly the oldest systematic school of Indian philosophy, which I'll speak briefly about now. Now, Samkhya means enumeration. And although we have the idea that much of Indian philosophy is monistic, is about one being pervading the universe, the Samkhya system, which is the oldest system, is dualistic. It maintains that there are at least two principles in the universe: the soul, the self, and matter, Prakriti, Purusha and Prakriti. And that the self, the Purusha, is entangled in matter. So the purpose of life is to free the spirit, is to free the soul from its entanglement in matter. Now, as to the question about how does the soul get entangled in matter in the first place, the Samkhya is silent, other than that it has always been entangled in matter. So you have an infinite number of souls, and they're all entangled in Prakriti, unless they're free. If they're liberated, that's their disentanglement from matter. And they're then in a state of isolation, Kaivalya, isolated in this liberated state. Now, according to Samkhya, there's no real, the Purusha is never really attached to Prakriti or matter, but it just has the illusion of attachment. So when I refer to the I, that's not my soul, that's within the realm of matter. So your everyday I, the person who you think you are, the person who uses language, is within the realm of matter. So your soul has to free itself from that bondage, even who you think you are even. So when you use I make a cup of tea, I perform sacrifice, that's not the real self. That's the Prakriti self, if you like. That's the self entangled in matter. So the Purusha needs to free itself from it. Now the Buddhists come along and say, well, that's all very well, but this self then is theoretically redundant. What do you need? What function does it have? It has no function. It doesn't explain any. It doesn't explain the I. It's not the subject of first person predicates. It doesn't explain anything. So they rejected the notion of an eternal self. Of course, as you know, it's a bit like the Jain view of the self as well. There's the Samkhya view. So Samkhya is very extremely influential school on the Buddhists and the Jains, as well as the Orthodox Hindu systems. So the Samkhya is a dualistic system, and it enumerates the levels of Prakriti, the levels of reality, which it calls categories, or tattva. Tattva means Latinus. So there are 24 evolutes of Prakriti. Prakriti is, if you like, is matter in incipient form, which then manifests or unfolds the universe. So out of this matter, this stuff of the universe, you get manifestation evolving or developing until you get the solidified world. So there's a hierarchy of levels here. And what's interesting is that cosmology corresponds to psychology. So it has these classifications which are... I'll do it in a kind of translation, but I don't want to put you off with Sanskrit terms. From matter, you get. I'm going to give you another Sanskrit word. Buddhi. Buddhi means, it's often translated intellect, but it means higher mind. as well. And it's not only individual, but it's a cosmic thing. So it's a part of the evolution of the cosmos, as it were. So the first evolution is Buddhi. And out of Buddhi, you get the I, the ego, which is called the Ahankara, the I maker. And out of that, you get the development of the five senses, of the five objects of sense. Five organs of action, and five subtle elements. I don't want to go into all the details of this, but so here, in this system, you've got the subtle elements of the universe, the objective universe, and the objects of sense, which are objective in the world. But you've also got the organs of sense, how you perceive them, all within the same classification scheme. So it's a bit similar to the Buddhist thing we were talking about a while back, where you have a consciousness, citta, corresponds to loka, as a state of consciousness, so the world of experience. And you have the jhanas and all those. So as you go up through the jhanas, you go through different worlds. So not dissimilar in the Samkhya tradition, where you have this hierarchy of tattvas, and which is a fusion of a classification of a human being and their senses with a classification of the universe beyond a human being, and kind of merged together. And this system, these tattvas, became extremely influential in all later Indian philosophy, and all Indian philosophers have to deal with it in some way. And it becomes particularly important in theories of causation, because on this view, this is called the Parinama theory of causation, which means that the effect, Satkaryavada Parinama, which means that the effect is pre-existent in the cause, as a pot is an effect of the clay which it contains, and the clay is transformed into the pot. So the universe and you and me is a transformation of this substance, matter, Prakriti. So we're a transformation of Prakriti. We are a transformation of Prakriti, but we're animated by the Purusha. And it's not, I mean, the text claims that there's no connection between Purusha and Prakriti, and that's the truth of its realization. But they also claim that Purusha is somehow the life force animating the Prakriti. So there's an ambiguity, as far as I can see, about the notion of Purusha. But certainly the Purusha is not the I, it's not the ego. So who we think we are is still within the realm of matter. So our freedom is to go beyond that.
Could you define Buddhi again, please?
Yeah, Buddhi is translated as intellect or higher mind. Most translations is intellect, but I quite like higher mind. It's also been translated as the unconscious. Herrera, I think, translates it as unconscious, the unconscious. So you can see why, because Buddhi contains the seeds of all later manifestation. So it's a real.
What is it that transforms one thing into another?
This is the primal stuff of the universe, which coagulates into different forms.
Why does it do that?
Yeah, why does it do that? That's a good question. The Samkhya has no response to that question, other than it always has done. And you've got seeds, you've got the gunas, principal qualities, gunas, which are incipient. Matter has two states. One is called unmanifest, avyakta, and the other is called manifest. And so this is manifest Prakriti. And it's avyakta Prakriti, it's unmanifest state. All this exists in potential as a seed. And every so often it emanates out, becomes manifest. Now, why does it do that? The reason, sort of karmic reasons, in the sense that the universe contracts back into this unmanifest state, and after a long period of time emanates back out again. Now, the Samkhya say it's always done that. It's never had a beginning or an end. Just always done that. The souls are always being entangled. So they don't have an adequate account of why that happens. they've got a sort of technical account in terms of these qualities of lightness, darkness, and energy, which go into quiescence, and then once it all starts up again, they have their own energy that sort of unfolds the universe. But it's not a, it's an atheistic system, so they don't have a god to start the whole system going. Shaivism, you get a very similar kind of thing, but Shiva impels it. Shiva acts upon matter to make the universe go again, to kick it into action. So that's a very ancient system of Indian philosophy. John.
Sorry to
interrupt.
Yeah. I missed that by the Prakriti.
Well, Prakriti, just means nature or matter, Prakriti.
That's another way of saying matter.
Yeah. Matter or nature. Yeah. Stuff. So that's the very ancient system. In the Upanishads you get elements of Samkhya. Samkhya means enumeration, so it's the enumeration of the elements of the universe. Classification system. The categories of the universe. Well, the Shaiva system is very interesting. With Shaivism, and we don't have time to get into this this time, but the Shaivas add another load of tattvas on top of this lot and integrate them in quite an interesting way. So they say, the Samkhya only goes up to that level, but we have a higher level, we go beyond that. And all the schools tend to do that somewhat. Now, yoga assumes the metaphysics of Samkhya. Samkhya and yoga are very closely connected together. So yoga, which we mean that by yoga, I mean that the system, the orthodox system of yoga, the classical system of Patanjali. Patanjali was who wrote the Yoga Sutras. I think we've looked at this. Defines yoga as the cessation of mental fluctuations. But the only point I want to make about it now, and we haven't got time to go into it, is that it's dualistic. That, like the Samkhya, the Patanjali's yoga is dualistic and maintains that the soul is quite distinct from matter. And it uses the same terminology, and the goal of life is to liberate the soul from matter. Now, yoga becomes to use much more generally and appropriated by the other Indian traditions as a method. But the philosophy of yoga is dualistic. Now, moving on rapidly, we've got the Vedanta system comprises two schools, again, the Mimamsa and the Vedanta. The Vedanta is sometimes called the Purva Mimamsa, the earlier Mimamsa, and the Uttara Mimamsa, the later Mimamsa. So the Vedanta tradition is sometimes called the later Mimamsa. Now, Mimamsa is a tradition of exegesis, Vedic exegesis. So it's all about commentaries on the texts and what the texts mean and why you do it. So they're not interested in yoga, they're interested in language, they're interested in the correct understanding of the Vedic revelation. So the main thing about this tradition is revelation is about injunction. Do this, don't do that. Vidhi, injunction. And it's an atheistic system again in origin, and the Veda has no beginning, it's authorless, has no beginning. So like the Samkhya, there's no theos here. To author the Veda is authorless. And you perform the actions of the Veda because it says so in the Veda, because the Veda is sacred revelation. And if you perform the sacrifice and you have the consequence of going to heaven as a result of performing the sacrifice, that's not why you perform the sacrifice. You perform the sacrifice because it says so, because it's an injunction. So ritual action is terribly important in the Mimamsa. And they have very interesting analyses of language, what the Vedic language is. And even one thinker, Kautsa, argues along the lines of Fritz Stahl that the Vedic ritual is action for its own sake, because the gods are merely terms in language, Kautsa says. Very interesting, very early to say something like that. Then you get, later on, you get developments out of that, the Vedanta, which is the end of the Veda, Anta, the end of the Veda, which is the tradition developing from the Upanishads. And within the Vedanta, we have, I'll talk about the Vedanta in a minute, that's the most influential school of Indian philosophy. And lastly, there are these two, Nyaya Vaisheshika. Nyaya is a school of logic based on the Nyaya Sutras in the first century. And the Vaisheshika is an atomistic or realistic school that says that the universe is made up of different atoms. So you get combinations of three atoms that join together, and the universe is made up of these combinations of these three atoms in more and more complex ways. It's a bit like the Greek, a bit the Demosthenes, I suppose. And the Vaisheshika is a realistic school then, and it's a very interesting tradition, and people like Halfas write about the Vaisheshikas in his system of in his book On Being and What There Is. It's a discussion of the Vaisheshika system. Now perhaps the most important in terms of general Hinduism of these traditions are the Mimamsa and Vedanta, particularly the Vedanta tradition, which has become so influential and important, has taken on it's not just a philosophy, it's more like a common world view shared by many Hindus, particularly middle class Hindus and educated Hindus in the West. And it's the most first of all, the Purvamimamsa, just quickly point you to some features of this. So it's a critical inquiry into Vedic texts. The Jaimini's Mimamsa Sutra is the first one, the first text here, about 400 BC, which is a commentary by Shabala. And there are two subdivisions by Kumarila and Prabhakara. So the first important fact about the universe is action. Sorry, that doesn't make sense what I've written there. Something's gone wrong. But anyway, activity is the most important feature of the universe. And it's about dharma. Dharma, this word dharma, which we've had over and over again, is enjoined by the Veda. And there are two kinds of action, those such as prayers and social duties, and those which have a purpose, such as happiness in the next world and riches in this. And you do ritual action because of is that that first kind of action. It's action for its own sake, because it says so in the Veda. And you don't do it because you want reward later on. And it hasn't got a God. The later system tended to bring God in, but earlier you don't have God. And souls are eternal, but only conscious through action. We only become conscious through our engagement with the world, through action. So in a sense, it's very different from Samkhya, where your higher consciousness is through detachment from action, through not being entangled in the world anymore. So it's almost the opposite, really. Now, developing out of this, you get Vedanta, which is what I want to speak of for the last 5 or 10 minutes, which is the most influential of the Indian philosophical schools, especially Shankara, who's like the Thomas Aquinas of Hinduism. And in this school, you've got reality as unitary. All differences are unreal, and the only reality is Brahman. That's the extreme form. That's the Advaita Vedanta, non-dual Vedanta. So, okay, the Vedanta itself, Vedanta, the end of the Veda, most influential Indian philosophical tradition. There are various branches of it, the most important of which perhaps is the Advaita, which is non-dualistic school. Or the most influential, perhaps, later on. But another very important one is called Vishishta Advaita, or qualified non-dualism. I don't know if you can do this. This is a real cook's tour, but at least you'll get a sketch of these traditions and can fill them out in your own room. And then dualism. So it's better to, I remind you, it's better to have had a sketch and have heard something about these things than not to have anything. So qualified non-dualism and dualism. By non-dualism, I mean there's only one reality in the universe. All difference is illusory. There's only one being. And all difference is illusory. That's Shankara. The only reality is this absolute Brahman, this absolute power.
So
we have another called Dvaita also. Oh, you got that, yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the three ones,
yes.
Three main ones,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Praita Dvaita is like this one, in the close to this.
Okay. So that's Advaita, Vishishta Advaita, Dvaita Advaita, and
Dvaita.
Yes,
Dvaita.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is So then you've got a qualified non-dualism, which is a theistic tradition, which I'll look at more next term, which argues that although Brahman pervades the universe, souls are distinct from God. They're not absolutely identical. Whereas for Shankara, all is one, as it were. And for Shankara, knowledge is more important than action. And for Shankara, you get knowledge, you get recognize yourself as the absolute. I'm going to ignore these other positions here. For the last 5 minutes, I'll talk about Advaita, which is the view that there's one being in the universe and difference is illusory. That's the fundamental position. And actually, Shankara makes a distinction between action and knowledge. And you understand the unity of Brahman through the Vedic revelation. This is what the Upanishads tell us. And there's a distinction in the text between sections about action and sections about knowledge. And you understand what's more important is sections about knowledge. So you are that, Tattvamasi, the great sayings. I am the absolute. All this is indeed the absolute. These five or six great sayings in the Upanishads are what makes you realize the truth of their content. So you hear the words and then there's a sudden gestalt, a sudden waking up to the truth that you are the absolute. As you see a rope in a corner and think it's a snake, when you realize it's a rope, there's that sudden recognition. So there's a sudden recognition that you are the absolute. Or you're walking along the beach and you see shells and you pick them up thinking they're money and it's shells. Have you done that, everyone? I've done that. Walked on the beach. You've seen shells. You picked it up. You think it's a coin.
It's Maya.
It's Maya. It's Maya. That's right. It's Maya. Yeah, Maya. That's an important word. Maya.
It's called fool's gold at Lyme Regis.
Fool's gold at
Lyme
Regis.
Out of the cliff, thinking it's real gold, and you find it's just worthless dust when it's analysed by a jeweller.
Oh, there we are.
That's Dorset Fool.
Yeah. Well, Shankara would have used that image had he lived in. Now his later thinkers rejected his distinction between how can you divide the text up like that. It's not a valid way of going about things. He also thought that action could not lead to liberation. You can meditate, meditation is an action, so you can meditate till you're blue in the face, but you'll never get liberated through meditation because it's an action, and action cannot lead to liberation. Ritual can't lead to liberation. No action can lead to liberation. Knowledge leads to liberation. Cognition. Seeing as suddenly, like shift of perception.
So, but isn't it paradoxical that he is supposed to have established the four mathas, which are the seat of Indian ritualism at the moment?
Oh, indeed.
Very, very
yes.
Paradoxical, actually.
He has founded these four traditions,
Yeah.
But his disciple Mandana Mishra disagreed with him. He thought meditation did lead to liberation. But you can nevertheless, for Shankara, prepare the ground for this sudden realization through practices of hearing the scriptures, thinking about the scriptures, and meditating upon the scriptures. So you think about them, hear them, you meditate, you think about them, and you meditate upon them. And that doesn't lead to liberation, but it prepares the ground for your ability to perceive the truth of the great sayings. So when he says meditation doesn't lead to liberation, is that a kind of messing around? But certainly he thinks that action cannot lead to liberation. And liberation, then, the final state of liberation, is knowing and experiencing the true self, the Atman. And he said, what is liberation? He said, it's not like arriving at a place. It's not like getting to a place. It's not like going to heaven. It's not like arriving at a place. It's not like... It's not the result of an action. And it's not like dying, and it's not like losing consciousness, he says. And he's, so what's it like? So he says, it's like what happens to the space inside a pot when the pot breaks. Or what happens to the light reflected in a mirror when the mirror is cleaned. So he uses these images to describe liberation. You can't attain it through effort, as it were, but you can... And you can get it through recognition, through understanding, waking up. And it's described negatively. As the Upanishads describe the absolute negatively, 1918, 1918, 1880. Not this, not this. So it's not like arriving at a place, and it's not like dying. But it's like waking up. And it can be achieved in this life. So it's Jivan Mukti, this idea of Jivan Mukti. The other thing about Shankara is he's terribly orthodox. He's although he's advocating quite a radical non-dualism, that all is one, as it were, he nevertheless wishes to maintain Varnashrama Dharma, the high values of maintaining your caste and status and your ritual purity. And only renouncers can achieve this state of Jivan Mukti. Householders can't. You have to achieve it through renunciation. Only renouncers have the ability to reach that knowledge, to gain that knowledge. And Jivan Mukti is the eradication of karma. Now, karma means action. It's a store of actions that are built up in your history, as it were, from the beginningless time of a soul's journey through the universe. And the karma has to be eradicated, and it's eradicated through this recognition, through cognition. It's not precisely clear to my mind how understanding or knowledge burns up karma, but it does, according to Shankara.
So that's are we talking about prarabdha over here?
Accumulated karma.
Yeah,
prarabdha. They call it accumulated karma.
Yeah, the prarabdha so that we collect over the.
And then there's the sanchitta is accumulated karma. That's what's burned up. The prarabdha karma is the karma you're beginning in this life, I remember, and the agamin is future karma.
Yes, sir, that's the account that we are using in this life, prarabdha.
Yeah, that's right. And the sanchitta is the storehouse behind
you.
Yes,
you're right.
So the accumulator. So the when you get Jivan Mukti, this is burned up, like as you stick a fire to a pile of cotton and it gets burned up. So liberation eradicates your sanchitta karma. But you still have this, prarabdha karma, to unfold in this life. So that's what the Jivan Mukti means, technically. Eradication of the accumulated karma, sanchitta karma, but leaves you to unfold the prarabdha, the karma that you've got for this life, which you have to unfold. So as a potter makes a pot and lets go of the pot, so that just unfolds, and then when you die, there's no more rebirth. And there's no more accumulation of new karma either, so you don't create new karma if you're a liberated soul, but you have to unfold what you've got for this life, otherwise you'll be dead, because the only thing that keeps you alive is the prarabdha karma.
The knowledge, it's like it helps us not to accumulate any karma any further, and then seek salvation?
Well, according to this, no, only a Jivan Mukta can eradicate future karma. So, unless we're liberated, we can't.
All right.
And you don't know whether what you're doing is the result of past actions or the creation of new. Unless you're a yogi.
Mm-hmm. Would you sort of achieve this knowledge and then it would just sort of always be there, or could you ostensibly forget?
Yeah, it's a good question. I wondered that. But according to Shankara, I think you once you've achieved it, it's just
it stays.
Stays.
It's Arknamin.
Arknamin. Arknamin means coming in karma. prarabdha means that for this life, prarabdha.
The check that you're drawing upon. That is the check
right.
that you're drawing
yeah,
upon.
Yeah, the check that you're drawing upon. Yes,
yeah,
this life. The karma that you're unfolding in this present life.
Vidya neither.
Yeah.
So he doesn't think that's bad. He doesn't think that's bad.
Well, it is bad, yeah, but you can't get rid of it till you die.
Right.
Because if you're liberated in this life, Jiva Mukti, you're alive. The fact that you're alive, you must have prarabdha karma to keep you going. So once you've died, the Jiva Mukta, when he comes to the end of his life, no, it's not a her, it's a his life, that gets eradicated too. There's no more prarabdha karma. But liberation is a burning up of that. Now, many schools don't accept that. That you can have Jiva Mukti. Anyway, so there's a real Cook's tour of thinking philosophy and some of the main developments.